From the American Tobacco Historic District, this is The State of Things. I'm David Crabtree. North Carolina is scheduled to carry out 3 executions in the next 4 weeks, bringing the number of executions performed in the state this year to 5. But in each of the upcoming scheduled executions, the family of the condemned is also the family of the victim. In the 11th hour clemency request, family members are asking the governor to commute death sentences to life in prison without parole. So what happens to the victim's rights when those rights are entangled with family ties? And what obligation does the state have in upholding death sentences when the victim's family asks that they be reduced? In full disclosure, I want to make it clear that on a personal basis, I have openly opposed and remain in opposition to the death penalty. However, during this discussion, I'm most interested in hearing what our guests and our listeners think about the role of the death penalty, and specifically clemency in North Carolina. And we welcome your calls this hour at 1-877-962-9862. Should the fact that the family of a victim is also the family of the accused mitigate a clemency request? Joining us here in the studio is Andrea Weigel, who has covered and written extensively of these execution sentences for the News and Observer. Thanks for being here.
Hi, David.
Let's first talk about what is scheduled in the next 4 weeks. All of these executions, scheduled executions, have confounding issues because, as we said, in each case, the condemned murdered a family member. Can you give us some background on each of the 3?
I certainly can. Stephen McCone, age 35, is scheduled to be executed this Friday morning at Central Prison in Raleigh. He shot his mother, Mildred Adams, and his stepfather, Wesley Adams Sr., in their Surry County home in 1990. The family in this case is very divided about whether the execution should be carried out. Wesley Adams Jr., who is Stephen's brother, was a witness to the crimes and actually disarmed Stephen twice that night. He still fears Stephen and wants to see the execution carried out. In fact, Stephen threatened to kill him and his wife that evening, and I think that has really still haunted him since that evening. On the other side of it, there are 3 siblings who followed their grandmother's advice and forgave Stephen and now are calling for the governor to grant clemency. So that's the first case that is up on Friday.
And that split between the family members appears to be very distinct.
Yes.
There's no gray area there.
No, there's no gray area. And there are other members who support Wesley Adams Jr. And want to see this execution carried out. I got an email from a niece over the weekend, and she was very adamant that they still fear Stephen and they want to see this go forward.
The family members that would like to see the death sentence reduced to life in prison, when they talk about their forgiveness, how does that sound?
Well, one of the women, Tina Walker, describes this very interesting incident. She had really been struggling with this request by her grandmother to forgive him, and she was up late one night and saw the movie Dead Man Walking. And then the next day, the sister, the nun who's featured in that film, was speaking at a nearby college, and she went to go hear her speak. And that was it for her. She could not support a death sentence for Stephen, and she started to reach out to him and has built a relationship with him. And she kept saying at the press conference last week, "I get it. I understand. I'm supposed to forgive him, and this is what I need to do for my faith."
But again, those on the other side, mm-hmm. particularly the family member who witnessed this, who fears for his safety, I presume.
Yes.
Help me understand, in your conversations with them, fearing for safety. If this person is locked up in prison for the rest of their life, how can they be a threat?
I don't know that they got into that, but they just felt like this was... You also have to understand that Wesley Adams witnessed his father's death, being shot with a shotgun. He described how his father was shot with a shotgun and collapsed into him. And so he's got his dying father in his hands. And he really described that distinct memory when he was talking about... needing to see justice done in this case, and justice for him is the death penalty.
And obviously, witnessing something like that, being held to something like that physically, emotionally, is far different than the abstract when some of us talk about the death penalty either in a pro or con situation. The second case, all family members favor a reduction of the sentence.
Yeah, that is stunning to me, having covered the death penalty for the last couple of years. Elias Siriani is 67. He stabbed his wife more than 25 times with a screwdriver outside their Charlotte home. His wife's name was Teresa. Their 10-year-old son, John, witnessed it and actually tried to stop his father. In that case, John, who is now 25, reached out to his father first, started writing to him in prison about a year after the killing, and went to go visit him in prison here in Raleigh when he turned 18. He has three sisters, Rose, Sarah, and Janet, and for all different reasons, they decided that they needed to confront their father after years of not having anything to do with him. And so in August of 2004, they traveled to North Carolina to see him with their brother, and the four of them went to visit. And the way they describe it, in one moment, this man turned from being this fearful monster of their past to, you know, the father that they had missed, and they, in an instant, forgave him.
I want to go back to a moment to the Mahone case, because that's coming up this week. When will the governor make his decision?
I'm not sure when the governor will make his decision. He doesn't typically announce his decision until after the courts have made all their final rulings.
And that oftentimes is 7 o'clock or later.
Yes.
On the night before the execution is to take place at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Right, so Thursday night at some time we anticipate an announcement.
Jim Coleman is a professor of law at Duke University. He's also here in the studio with us. Jim, good to have you here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Governor Easley, being a former prosecutor, former state attorney general, a pro-death penalty governor, is faced with something that he hasn't necessarily faced in the past. How different is this?
You mean the fact that members of the family are appealing to him to grant clemency?
Members of the family who are members of the family of the condemned and of the victim.
And of the victim, that's right. I think it is different, although I think that the governor faced this in the Daniels case last year or 2 years ago, a Charlotte case where some members of the family appealed to the governor to grant clemency. But this one is different because of the level of publicity that surrounds the family members who are very publicly asking the governor to grant clemency. What it takes away is, I think, what prosecutors often use in these cases, and that is the victim's family as the reason to carry out the execution. That's been eliminated because here they're split. And in one case, I guess in the Sirianni case, the four siblings are supporting their father's petition for clemency, where their mother was the victim.
And in that case, when they held their news conference or their public appearance, was it a week ago?
2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago. They were very emotional.
They were. I can't quite imagine going through 4 days of traveling the state and talking to people and being able to talk about things that are that emotional. And they did every time.
But when it comes to the governor making a decision, emotions can play no role.
Well, I don't know.
Or can they?
I don't know that that's true. I mean, I think the governor, you know, he's the last resort for mercy in these cases. I think the way that the governor has approached it in the past, though, has been that he sits as some kind of super appellate judge to see if there have been errors, and he concludes that if there have not been legal errors, then he lets the execution go forward. In fact, I think his role is more like a super juror, which is to decide whether there is any reason to grant mercy without regard to whether there are legal issues in the case that haven't been resolved.
How long has the death penalty been on the books in this state?
Well, in modern time, it's been on the books since 1973, after the Supreme Court declared the death penalty unconstitutional in a case called Furman versus Georgia. And then North Carolina had to reinstitute its death penalty in 1997 because the Supreme Court decided that the mandatory death penalty that it enacted in 73 was unconstitutional.
And Jim, in death cases, death penalty cases, I mean, there are mitigating and aggravating circumstances that are involved. a death resulting from some act of violence doesn't always lead to a prosecutor seeking or having the ability to seek the death penalty.
That's correct. And in the last few years, the prosecutors have had the option not to seek the death penalty, even in cases where there are aggravating factors that could have gone to the jury. And I think the effect of that change in the law has been that we have many fewer cases in which the death penalty is sought, and then even fewer cases in which the jury imposes a death sentence.
Going back to the clemency hearings, one thing that makes hearings different now, just a very short time ago, there was not an option in this state for a jury to decide life in prison without parole in place of the death penalty. And some of these cases that have come before the governor were decided by a jury that did not have the option, that same jury would have had the option today. Do you sense that plays on Mike Easley's decision making?
Well, I think it ought to, because I think that what that reflects is that the attitude of the people of North Carolina has changed about what's appropriate for people who are accused and then convicted of killing. And I think that the people of North Carolina now feel that life without parole is an appropriate alternative.
This is The State of Things. We're talking today about clemency for death penalty cases in North Carolina. Andrea Weigel of the News and Observer and Jim Coleman, a professor of law at Duke University, are with us. And we're taking your calls at 1-877-962-9862. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm David Crabtree. We're talking today about clemency and death penalty cases in North Carolina. There are three executions scheduled before the end of this year. All three cases involve a man who killed a member of his own family. That means the victim's family and the condemned man's family are often the same family. For some, this raises many questions about the clemency process. Andrea Weigel of the News and Observer is with us, as is Jim Coleman, professor of law at Duke University. Let's talk about sentencing structure in this state, Jim, and how this works in possible death penalty cases.
Okay. You want to discuss how the sentencing is actually done by the jury in North Carolina?
Yeah, and oftentimes what prosecutors are looking for when they are going for this penalty in a given case, and what keeps them from doing that?
Well, the first thing is that it's available only for murder, first-degree murder. And then secondly, there has to be what's called a statutory aggravating factor in the case. That is something besides simply that the person was killed. For example, that the person was killed for pecuniary gain, that is for money, that in killing one person, the defendant engaged in some course of conduct that threatened the lives of other people. So there has to be an aggravating factor found. That then makes the person eligible for the death penalty. The jury, however, is then permitted to consider any evidence in mitigation. And then the jury is supposed to weigh the aggravating factors against the mitigating factors and decide whether, given the balance, the person should be sentenced to death. But there's no circumstance in which the jury is required to sentence a person to death, even if the aggravating factors outweigh the mitigating factors.
Can a judge, the presiding judge, override the jury in the sentencing phase?
No, not in North Carolina.
In a recent case, Andrea, in Raleigh, the NC State tailgating killings that took place September a year ago, we had, in the sentencing phase, family members of one of the Johnson brothers come forward and beg for mercy on that court. We did not hear from the victims' families either wanting to excuse that penalty or arguing for it. Hmm. And my presumption is that had to have an impact on what happened inside that courtroom.
Yeah, I don't know what the prosecutor's thinking was in the sentencing phase to not put the family on. There may not have been a family member who was willing or able. I mean, it's a very emotional thing. I remember dealing with some of the family members out of Chicago, and they were very torn up about it. And they may not have been able to hold it together on the stand. We just don't know.
What do you sense in your covering these current cases and talking with family members and also talking with those with the state? I mean, the Attorney General's office has a division whose work is to carry out sentences. That's their job. Very honorable profession. It's what they do. They will be arguing against clemency, tooth and nail.
Mm-hmm.
Family members are aware of this, but do you sense they are really aware of how difficult that fight will be?
In the Sirianni case, no, they're not even, they were not even really aware of the possibility that their father may be executed. They weren't even really in touch with that true possibility. They were just so focused on begging for his life. I don't know whether they realize how difficult the odds are that the governor will hear them. But interestingly enough, in that case, the Sirianni children have not been guaranteed an audience with the governor on Thursday when the clemency hearing happens. But from what I understand, the district attorney's representative from Charlotte is going to ask the governor to speak to the Sirianni children, and the defense lawyers are going to ask the governor to meet with the Sirianni children. So it's still, I'm sure they will be at the Capitol Thursday, but whether they get to meet Mike Easley face-to-face is an unknown.
We are discussing clemency issues in North Carolina this afternoon, and we'd like to hear from you. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. Jim Coleman is a professor of law at Duke University. Jim, when we're looking at the sentencing procedure, what roles do the victim's family actually play in this?
Well, unless they're witnesses to the crime, they have a very limited role, which is during the penalty phase of the trial when the jury is presented the evidence and mitigation and the aggravating circumstances. Sometimes the prosecutors will put on a member of the victim's family to talk about the impact that the homicide has had on the family. It's called victim impact statement, and that becomes very emotional part of the trial. Notwithstanding the effort to try to sort of keep it focused on the bare facts.
With that in mind, Mel Chilton is the executive director of the North Carolina Victims Assistance Network. She joins us now from her office in Raleigh. Thanks for speaking with us today.
You're welcome.
Mel, your organization opposes any moratorium on executions in this state. So does that mean that you solidly favor the death penalty as it stands today?
We do favor the death penalty. The majority of our members have voted, and that was the decision of our majority.
What benefits does that form of punishment have that life parole does not?
It's not a benefit, but it is justice being served. It is my opinion that the death penalty prevents the offender from killing again. It also deters in that people recognize there is finality to their behavior. There will be consequences.
You have, I understand, a heartbreaking story, very personal in your own life, which speaks to some of the cases in which life in prison would not prevent a criminal from acting out again. Would you mind sharing that story with us?
I would be glad to. In my own case, it was during the time that the death penalty was ruled unconstitutional. May 19, 1975, my mother was strangled to death by an inmate in minimum security prison. It is that action that has made me such a strong proponent of the death penalty, because I know from firsthand experience that inmates get access to innocent lives again. The citizens of our state do not realize how much they're jeopardized on a daily basis by people who have committed heinous crimes. And it is so important that we get across to the public that their safety is jeopardized on a regular basis.
Have you considered an alternative that if that security that was laxed in that terrible case regarding your family, if that security was tightened where that access was not given, would that make a difference in your feeling?
There's no way to isolate an inmate to the point that he doesn't have access to other human beings, and even other inmates deserve their safety, they should not be jeopardized on a daily basis, and they do get access to other human beings.
Again, we're taking your calls this afternoon here on The State of Things, and Jim from Chapel Hill is joining us now. Jim, thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a sort of a fundamental question. That is, why do we have the death penalty? What is the emotional and intellectual process that has resulted in the death penalty for certain convicted persons?
Okay, Jim, I'll get an answer from both Professor Coleman and from Mel Chilton. Thank you for calling.
Well, there are two reasons that are offered for the death penalty. One is deterrence, and I think Mel mentioned that. That is that by executing the offender, it deters others from committing homicide or murder. The other reason is retribution, and the notion there is that for some crimes, the only appropriate punishment is death, and that anything less than death unsettles the community.
Mel Chilton, would you like to respond to that question?
I believe that Professor Coleman has covered the two reasons. I don't think in retribution, we hear many times as crime victims that there's a perception of vengeance, and that is not a part of it. It is a part of putting an end to something that crime victims live with day after day, year after year. My own case is over 30 years ago, and it is as much a part of my life today as it was then.
You know, I have interviewed several people over the years who were survivors of the victim, survivors of the victims who have gone on to witness an execution.
Mm-hmm.
Or the execution has taken place, they chose not to witness it, and have told me in follow-up conversations, this really didn't add closure or the closure I was looking for. I don't know that it made any difference. And in all fairness, I am not speaking for all of society. These are just specific cases. If you heard that from someone, how would you respond to them?
Are you asking me?
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, Mel.
There is no closure. I have members of our organization. I speak to many of the victims that have witnessed executions, and there is no closure. But what there is for them is that peace of not having to wake up in the night and worry about what is going to happen next. What is he going to do next? They can no longer be a threat to that family's life. There is a peace, and those that have witnessed it have expressed to me that there is a peace in knowing it is over. What I live with is that fear and that threat every day. Is he going to get out this year?
Hmm. If the Sirianni children were with us in this room today, and I'm sure you've heard their story, you may have heard some of them, their comments on the air, or read their comments in the paper. What would you say to them?
My heart goes out to this family, and I know they are tormented. There is no winning in this situation. They have lost both of their parents, regardless of what the governor's decision is. And the governor has a very difficult decision. But I believe he will make the right one based on law, not on emotion. He will do what he has to do to uphold the law of our state.
Mel, is there any case that you know of where you would advocate for a reduction in the sentence of death versus the death sentence?
It is a case-by-case situation. I personally don't know of a particular case. But in the decisions that the governor has made in the past, I very much agreed with his decision. So, you know, I can't specifically name one for you, but he has done an excellent job in making these decisions.
We're discussing clemency and the death penalty in North Carolina. Three executions are scheduled within the next 25 days. We're also taking your calls this afternoon on the state of things at 1-877-962-9862. Mel Chilton with the North Carolina Victims Assistance Network is with us by phone. Jim Coleman from Duke University Law School with us in the studio, as is Andrea Weigel, who has covered these pending executions and written about them extensively. You mentioned in the McCone case earlier the brother that is saying he wants to see this through. Does he expect the execution to begin this closure process that so many people think exists? It may actually exist for some, but as Mel Chilton says, that's not really the focal point.
I got the sense from him and his wife Wendy that the fear that they have surrounding Stephen McCone will abate now once he's executed, that they will no longer fear for their family once he is gone.
And the fear, those who do fear someone actually getting out of prison by whatever means, is very real and tangible if it's happened in their family.
Right. And I mean, we saw the case, I guess there was an inmate who escaped last week from Texas who was just picked up in Louisiana. And, you know, they hear stories like that and it fuels their fear.
Jim Coleman, you mentioned earlier that when I asked you the question about emotions and should they play a role, they shouldn't play a role. And you mentioned because the governor is that last person who could grant mercy, and I think was the word you used. You heard what Mel Chilton said about that. How do you respond?
Well, the governor has the exclusive power to grant clemency in these cases. And there's no legal guideline for how that's done. He upholds the law, whatever he does. But for the governor to approach it as if it's some narrow legal review that he's conducting, I think undermines what the purpose of clemency was, which is for the governor in the appropriate cases to grant mercy when mercy is called for.
The Sirianni case also obviously involves domestic abuse. So does that history of domestic abuse make the process of forgiveness more complicated?
Well, I cannot even imagine what those four children went through in their life, having to try to forgive their father for killing their mother. And there were instances of domestic violence that came out of the trial leading up to that killing, which they witnessed as children. But the one thing that really struck me when I listened to them 2 weeks ago when they were here is that the only connection they have to their mother is their father. He is the only one that can remind them of memories that they had forgotten. And so I can only suspect that it's really hard for them to let go of that connection, even despite the horrible thing that he did.
Let's go back to the phones. Beth from Durham is on the line. Beth?
Hi. I have a question about the case that's coming up this week and what circumstances alcohol and substances might have played in Steve McCone's ability to think about and plan this crime ahead of time.
Andrea?
Yeah, that's an issue that his defense lawyers are raising. And they're also saying that it wasn't fully explored at the trial, and therefore he needs to or deserves a new trial. There are varying reports that he drank a pint and a half or a bottle and a half of Jack Daniels. He may have done some drugs. He drank a pitcher of beer all leading up to the events that night and then got in a very heated argument with his parents when they got home about some stuff. And there've been the one thing that's really at issue is that Wesley Adams Jr., the eyewitness, told police that Stephen McCone was intoxicated at the time of the killing, but then got on the stand later and said he wasn't intoxicated. And so the defense lawyers are trying to use that to their advantage. And of course, if you're intoxicated, you cannot form this specific intent. This is the argument of the defense. You cannot form the specific intent to commit first-degree murder. And so that's their argument.
Beth, we appreciate that call. Let's go to Edith now in Raleigh. Edith, thanks for your call.
Governor Jim Hunt expressed after he was out of office regret that he had not commuted the death sentence of one man I cannot remember that man's name, but this was, his family pleaded for him, but Governor Hunt would not do it. There was a lot of publicity about that case. I just wanted to share that with you. I wish I could give you more details, but this was a family who were together. I don't think anybody in the family was against that, but...
Okay, Edith, we appreciate your call. No one here in the studio remembers the specifics of that case or the knowledge of that case, not denying that it happened. It's just something that we don't recall. Ronald Fry was another case where abuse was a mitigating factor. That was a case that received a lot of publicity, and it's a name. His is a name that is still tossed out there often in these cases. Jim Coleman, you're nodding in agreement with that.
No, I think that's right, and... You know, I have heard people say that that's one of the cases where the governor, this governor, may have had some regrets that he did not grant clemency. I think that particularly after the execution and the photographs of Fryer as a young child that were used by the police to demonstrate abuse had an impact on the governor.
We're talking about clemency for death penalty cases here in the state of North Carolina with Andrea Weigel from the News and Observer, Jim Coleman from Duke University Law School, and Mel Chilton, the executive director of the North Carolina Victims Assistance Network. Just ahead, more of your calls at 1-877-962-9862 on the State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm David Crabtree. We're talking this hour about clemency and death penalty cases here in North Carolina. Andrea Weigel of the News and Observer is with us, as are Jim Coleman, a professor of law at Duke, and Mel Chilton of the North Carolina Victims Assistance Network. And we're taking your calls at 1-877-962-9862. If the family of the condemned is also the family of the victim and they appeal for clemency, should the governor listen more closely? That's been the focus of the discussion, although we have discussed some other issues as well. And before the break, we were talking a little bit. We mentioned Ronald Fry. He was executed the last day of August of 2001, severely abused as a child, was into drug and alcohol abuse later in life, but many of these factors did not come out in his trial. Professor Coleman, there have been people who have railed against this type of the testimony being left out or at the fact that they consider some defense attorneys, some anti-death penalty advocates, using these examples as what they would term a crutch for behavior that was not adhered to by the accused.
Well, but that's the whole point of sentencing in capital cases, which is for the juries to take into consideration not simply the crime, but the person's whole life, and to determine whether there's anything in the person's life on balance that deserves mercy. And I think that, you know, in the case of Ronald Fryer, the fact that he had been so severely abused as a child had, in effect, escaped the attention of the system in the sense that the system did not protect him in the way that it was intended to. That's a factor that the jury should take into consideration.
And in some cases, I think in this case as well, a defense attorney who slept through part of the trial,
yeah,
who was an alcohol abuser. When we hear these things, there are times, it's like, how does this happen? How does a judge not know what's going on and allow that to happen?
Well, the judges do know what's going on often. The prosecutors know what's going on. They think it's not their role to step in and do anything about it. That's why we ought to be embarrassed by the system that we have that tolerates this kind of conduct, that defends this kind of conduct. I don't think any of us would want our own life to be in the hands of some of the lawyers who defended people who are on death row in North Carolina now.
Mel Chilton, are you embarrassed?
No. Every capital case has two attorneys. Not one, but two. And I don't see any reason to be embarrassed about our system. I think our system is working. It's just a lot slower than most of our crime victims would like it to be.
Let's take another call. This from Steve in Roxboro. Steve, thanks for calling The State of Things. Steve, are you with us? Do we have Steve or have we lost Steve? We don't have Steve. Okay, let's go to Kim and Kerry. Kim, thanks for calling the State of Things.
Yes, hi, how are you doing?
Good, thank you.
I guess my comment is that with the death penalty, you can commit such a horrible murder, and some people don't get the death penalty, and then other people do. And it just seems to me to be such a unfair law. I mean, you know, if you're really for the death penalty, then everyone that kills someone should be killed. Or should get the death penalty.
That is a broad brushstroke. My words, not anyone else in this studio, that is favored by some people. That's pretty black. That's very black and white, Kim. If you want to make sure I understand this, that there would be no mitigating circumstances, no first degree, second degree murder, no manslaughter, voluntary, involuntary, just black and white.
People just do horrible, horrible murders, and then they don't get the death penalty, and then there's someone else that commits a murder. For me, it doesn't seem as if it's as heinous as the other, but they get the death penalty, and then the next person doesn't. And I will say I'm totally against the death penalty. I think it's a horrible, horrible thing.
Okay, let's go to Professor Coleman. Kim, thanks for your call. Professor, who does get the death penalty? I mean, you've mentioned it a bit earlier, but she raises the same question again.
Well, it's a very good point. I mean, Mel said that what she wants is she wants justice to be served in these cases. The problem is that the death penalty is like a lottery. I mean, it's North Carolina's first lottery. Who gets the death penalty depends on things like where the murder was committed. You know, who the lawyer is, who represents the person, who the prosecutor was, who the members of the jury were, and so forth. And as a result, you get a lot of inconsistent, arbitrary decisions in these cases. There's no meaningful way to distinguish between cases where the death penalty is imposed and cases that involve just as heinous murders, but the death penalty is not imposed.
Race can be a factor in who gets the death penalty.
And it's one of the principal factors in a lot of cases. The race of the victim is a factor that will increase the likelihood that the death penalty will be imposed. And particularly if a black person kills a white victim, that is the most likely case in which the death penalty will be imposed.
Mel Chilton, you just heard Professor Coleman describe the death penalty as North Carolina's first lottery.
I do not agree. In my opinion, justice is being served. The basis for the death penalty is based on the aggravating and mitigating circumstances. We have elected our DAs, and their job is being carried out based on law. And I do not agree that it's a lottery.
What about when the law makes a mistake? Daryl Hunt, as an example.
Daryl Hunt is not a capital case. He did not get the death penalty.
Well, but
the law made a mistake in his case.
Mr. Hunt was found not guilty of the charges that he was being held for, but there is evidence that he was a party to that situation. He was let go based on the evidence that was there at the time, and I believe DNA is what helped him to get released.
Okay, well, we've got several calls I want to get to, but before we do, I want to go to Jim Coleman because you were shaking your head when she was talking there, Jim, and there are people, several people I've heard from, who are not yet buying into new evidence, whether it's DNA or whatever it may be, of saying, wait a second, the police didn't make a mistake, the prosecutor didn't make a mistake, the jury didn't make a mistake, the judge didn't make a mistake. Don't come back to me now and say the system's not working.
See, this is the problem with the death penalty. Once you commit to it, then you've got to ignore all of the evidence to the contrary and stay focused on that. I think that, with all due respect to Mel, that it's outrageous to suggest that Daryl Hunt had any involvement in the case for which he was wrongfully convicted. The Winston-Salem Police Department exonerated him. They said, without qualification, he was not involved. He had nothing to do with it. And I think those are the facts. But I think it's very difficult for people who support the death penalty to admit that we make mistakes. And by the way,
he's not a capital case.
His case was a capital case initially. He simply didn't get the death penalty. And I think the reason for that was because his first jury had doubts about whether he had done it. And so the compromise was to convict him but not sentence him to death.
Let's go to Ben, who's on the phone from Climax. Ben, I understand you are a supporter of the death penalty. He's gone. All right, with that in mind, let's go to Steve, who is in Roxborough. Steve, we tried to get you earlier. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Good afternoon. Thanks for calling us.
Thank you. I would like to say that I'm in favor of severe punishment, solitary confinement for life, no parole, reopen Alcatraz, whatever you'd like to do. I'm opposed to the death penalty. I think as a society, we should have matured past the point of wanting to do that kind of thing as a final punishment. And I particularly have compassion for the lady you're interviewing, but it seems that in her case, it would not have made difference because the person who killed her mother was not already on death row.
Mel, do you want to respond to that?
He was serving a life sentence for rape.
Then I certainly am in favor of severe punishment. I'm in favor of keeping people put out of society, but I'm not in favor of killing them to get even.
It's not about getting even, sir. It's about your safety, and when you let inmates have access to other human beings, then violence occurs.
And I would agree with that, and I'm in favor of never giving them access again.
Will you tell me how we're going to have prisons that no one has access to other humans?
Well, you can put them in total solitary. You can put them in Alcatraz or somewhere where even if they get loose, they can't get off the island. There are ways to get it done, but I think that what you're asking for when you kill people is more revenge and retribution than it is anything else.
All right, Steve, thank you so much for your call. Mel, I'm just curious, would you like to see, or do you believe the death penalty should be applied to more cases, more crimes than we see it applied to now here in North Carolina?
When human life has been taken, I believe that it needs to be applied when it's brutal murder. I don't know that I can say that it's more or less. It is when it's applicable to the safety of you and I and those who are innocent in our society.
David from Rocky Mount is on the line with us now. David, thanks for calling the State of Things.
Yeah, I'm opposed to that penalty and for several reasons. One is, for instance, we had some murders here in North Carolina, in Greensboro. A few friends of mine got killed. They were on camera where they had their shootout at the cannon police. Nobody spent a night in jail over that, and nobody on the right ever said much. The people on the right that are so much for the death penalty are the same ones that are in favor of the silly war in Iraq. Some other people who are in favor of the death penalty are opposed to abortion. It's a kind of hypocrisy that goes on.
Okay.
I can't afford it.
Okay, David, thanks for your call. He mentioned something at the very end saying, I can't afford it. One of the arguments for clemency cases and or this penalty in general is the cost to the state. The appeals process can run into the millions at times. On the other side of that coin, people say keeping people on death row and or in prison in general is costing astronomical amounts of money. Where is the balance in the cost, and do we place a cost on any human life? Jim?
Well, Phil Cook, who is a professor at the Duke Public Policy School, did a study a few years ago about the cost of the death penalty relative to the cost of a system that does not have the death penalty, and found that it was significantly more expensive to seek the death penalty and to carry it out. And that's a factor that for some people should be considered in determining whether we are to have it.
Kevin from Greensboro is on the line. Kevin, I understand this idea of money is on your mind.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's been that idea that was just cited has been known for a long, long time, I think. And I just think that if we if we instituted a policy of total abolition of the death penalty, I think you'd see a lot more equitable treatment of people receiving sentences for capital murder, regardless of what degree it is. I think it would take out a lot of ambiguity, and it would remove the burden from the state or the burden from people trying to prosecute the case that someone should receive the death penalty in this particular case and have to go all, you know, down all those little rabbit holes to, you know, find out all the mitigating factors. It would just eliminate most of that.
Okay, Kevin.
And I think it would save a lot of time.
Thanks for your call. Mel, when you hear a comment like that, do you agree with what he is saying, or do you think the appeals process should be shortened? I know a few years ago, the Attorney General's office was successful in this state of streamlining the appeals process somewhat, yet there's people on death row who have been there for 30 years.
The process is very slow and very lengthy, and it's a very difficult struggle for crime victims and those surviving family members who have gone 10-plus years waiting for the end of this appellate process. But it is so important that it be done right, and so that's why it is a lengthy process. It would be wonderful if it were shortened. I think all cases, regardless of whether they're homicides or whether it's a robbery, the criminal justice system is a slow one. But I do feel that it is important to see this justice be served and that it come to an end and these families seek peace. If it is your son or your daughter or your mother or your wife, you would feel entirely different about it.
Let's take another call from Ida in Chapel Hill. Ida, thanks for calling.
I have a question. I guess we could call it a question or a comment. My understanding is that laws, including capital ones for capital offenses, are for the purpose of regulating behavior, that justice, vengeance, etc., it's not a part of our legal system, and I hope it neither will ever become a part of our legal system, and I would like a comment on that. Let me put it another way. The more we talk about laws and capital punishment, etc., from the perspective of justice or vengeance, the more it seems to me that it corrupts the very purpose for which laws have been enacted.
Ida, thank you for your call. So my question, I'll put it to Professor Coleman and to Mel Chilton. Are we confusing regulation and justice?
Well, I think that the caller is correct that one of the principal purposes of the criminal law is to regulate behavior, but also to protect the public. And the question for the death penalty is what's necessary to protect the public? I think some people seek vengeance, and that goes beyond what's necessary to protect the public.
Mel Chilton, last word to you on this.
Again, it is not about vengeance. It's about putting the end of a situation that families have lived with for years and years. They want to see an end and peace to their case. They live in fear that this person is going to access another human being and cause violence in their lives.
Thank you, Mel. Our thanks to Andrea Weigel, a reporter with the News and Observer, and you are scheduled to witness this execution.
The Sirianni case.
The Sirianni case.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for being here, Andrea. Jim Coleman, professor at Duke, professor of law at Duke University. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mel Chilton, the executive director of the North Carolina Victims Assistance Network. We thank you for talking with us as well. That is the state of things for today. Thanks for listening. If you have a comment about this program, drop us an email here at sot@wunc.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm David Crabtree.